Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. It is a freezing and snowy start to the week as we edge ever nearer to some more good news about getting back to normal. After last week's predictions that the economy will bounce back strongly later this year, we're now hearing noises about more taxes for online businesses that have done so well. Not the greatest idea anyone ever had. The whole point of this government is that it gave away a load of money which it didn't have. The whole point of this government is that it always knew that they would have to try and recoup that money because they didn't have it in the first place to give it away. Do you see what I'm saying? But the answer is not to put more taxes on people. The answer is to spend more money to boost the economy so that people get back to work, people spend more money, the economy recovers, and Bob's your uncle. I've been arguing this for a very long time. I don't expect the government to put a spanner in the works. We're also hearing about a vaccine amnesty this morning for illegal immigrants who could register for a COVID jab without risking anything else happening to them. Now, some people think there's about 1.3 or possibly 1.5 million people in this country illegally. I actually think this is a pretty good idea, because if people come to register at a local GP surgery with the promise that nothing is going to happen to them, at least we will finally know precisely how many people are here, because at the moment I don't think the Home Office has got a Scooby, if you know what I'm saying. We're kicking off this morning with a look at the recent statistics with Jamie Jenkins, former head of health analysis at the Office for National Statistics. Things are continuing to head in the right direction, ladies and gentlemen, so we want to hear from you all as well. Are you snowed in? Are you back at work? What are you hearing? Seemed a bit quiet out there this morning. 03444991000. Coming up later on, Peter Hitchens joins us from the Mail on Sunday. This is also the week he goes head-to-head with Dan Hodges right here on Talk Radio TV. We'll get his latest take on the state of play. This weekend, he was accused of picking fights because of the heinous crime, as he called it, of asking for evidence. Extraordinary. And Stuart Weir joins us as well in a big week for the Scottish National Party as former First Minister Alex Salmond prepares to give evidence before a committee of inquiry tomorrow. His former protege, Nicola Sturgeon, will appear next week. What is it all about? And could it really bring her down? 03444991000. Also, we'll be taking another look at universities in this country, because as if you didn't know, right, it turns out that there's a load of individual academics who are being investigated because of their possible assistance in helping China to build weapons of mass destruction. Now, I told you last week I thought it would be a great idea if we never bothered reopening universities, because they are places where our young people get basically indoctrinated into thinking ridiculous thoughts and into becoming complete and utter snowflakes. Now it turns out we're also helping China. Great. Well done. Brilliant. Congratulations. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, time to say a very good morning to Jamie Jenkins, former head of health analysis at the Office for National Statistics. Jamie, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike. You good?
Yeah, very well indeed. Welcome back. How are things in snowy Wales?
Well, we've kind of missed the snow, actually.
Have you?
We've had a couple of dustings over the last few weekends before, but yeah, we've been kind of lucky this time.
Oh, that's good. Now, looking at the figures, which are an awful lot better than the last time you and I spoke, I think you were predicting that this was probably going to happen. Tell us what you've seen the most recent statistics showing.
Yeah, so obviously the country's kind of in this lockdown and we're looking for some hope. So the good news, let's start with all the good news then. And so cases, I've put a kind of a map up on my Twitter profile just looking at what the situation was in terms of the percentage of COVID test coming back positive about in the 7 days to the 2nd of January. And then I've put one to the other side on the same tweet to look at the cases in the 7 days to the 2nd of February. And yeah. I kind of looked at the kind of the rates and colored the map in regards to when it's more green. We're seeing kind of the green shoots of recovery, I suppose. And generally, Mike, everywhere across the country is improving. We're seeing kind of that massive surge that we had in London and the southeast. Possibly there was a lot of discussion about this variant. Mm. Well, cases have come down dramatically in London and the southeast. They've come down across all parts of the country as well, in the north, the southwest, Wales, etc. So we're seeing some really good improvement. Now, I think what's actually interesting as well, when you do look at the data, though, there are some pockets, Mike, where things have actually got a little bit worse over the last month. And if you think in Wales, we went into a kind of a national lockdown, I think, on the 20th of December, and there was very few cases on the Isle of Anglesey, which has got kind of got a little bit of a bridge, you could say. It's got its own little border there, yes, in terms of trying to stop people going in. But Anglesey's actually got worse. So it could well be that things are improving across the country. A few areas have got worse. But it's surprising, I suppose, that if lockdowns are that brilliant at stopping the virus spread, then there's some parts of, like, say, North Wales have got worse since we've had lockdown.
Which is interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, we've seen in the last week the Isle of Man completely lifting restrictions altogether. People back in pubs drinking, people basically not in lockdown at all anymore. So it's strange, isn't it, that you could do that in the Isle of Man, but you can't do it somewhere like Anglesey?
Well, obviously, they've got on top of things on the Isle of Man. I think the thing we should probably look at, Mike, as well as just the cases, is what's kind of happening within hospitals and what's happening with the deaths. So if we look at the facts on kind of the deaths that are talked about on the news every single day, so there's no hiding from the fact that deaths are higher than they are for the time of year normally. We've had about 5,500 deaths for the latest week that we saw, above average. Now, the total number of COVID deaths in the same week was higher than that. So it does give us some indication, the latest data, Mike, that there are people sadly dying with COVID at the moment who probably would have died anyway. And obviously every death is a tragedy regardless of things. Now, if we also look at the kind of the age profile of these deaths, now 83% of all the deaths in the latest week for people over the age of 70, and actually it's 4 in 10 over the age of 85. Now, one of the other things that I think we haven't really learned much from the first wave back in March is that, again, and it's been consistent practically every single week, that 1 in 5 of all of the deaths that we've got at the moment are occurring in care homes. And since the start of March last year, Mike, that's 25,000 people have died in care homes. That excludes all the people who have caught the virus perhaps in a care home and then gone into hospital and died. So I think for me, that kind of, it's all about those lessons learned that we need to look at, because I don't think, sadly, care home residents have been popping to the supermarkets to pick up, you know, groceries, etc. They are, a lot of these care homes have been locked down. So sadly, the virus is getting in. We've got a huge amount of deaths still going on in care homes. And I think we've made the point to you before, surely some targeted efficient testing would have been far more efficient to save lives.
Well, you would think so, because, I mean, the other thing that I find interesting, Jamie, is that, you know, last year we were having a lot of conversations with people about the way these figures have been put together. And you're a statistician, so you can help me with this. I mean, basically, it's now been accepted by almost everyone, including those in the government and those who formerly used to criticise the government, that basically the 100,000 deaths figure is not in any way to be challenged, not in any way to be asked questions about, when in fact we know that it may well be that because you got a COVID test positive 28 days before you died, therefore you're counted as a COVID death. You know, that does not necessarily mean that every single death was caused by COVID, does it?
No, and so I think the best metric to actually use is when you look at how many deaths are kind of registered or occur in a week, and then you can compare that to what would we have expected that to have been if there was no kind of virus in kind of the community at the moment. So if you go back,
if it was just a regular winter, I suppose you might say, right?
Yeah, if it's a regular winter. Now, if we go back to the first wave back in the spring, because we weren't testing many, actually the government's official number they were publishing every day was actually an undercount of what was going on, because we didn't know that people were dying of this virus and they were then being picked up with the death certificates. So the first wave, we were undercounting things. But for the second wave, because there's so much testing going on, we're probably overcounting. So in the latest week, there was about, say, 5,500 deaths over and above average for the time of year. They were actually in the same week, 8,500 COVID deaths. So that suggests that there were kind of deaths that are occurring at the moment, Mike, that probably would have occurred anyway. Somebody may have sadly had, say, cancer and test positive for COVID.
Right.
They are included in the official government number, which is published every single day. But I think we should focus more on that excess deaths. It is above average for the time of year at the moment.
But this is the thing. I mean, I'm not in the business of trying to dismiss the disease or say it's not as important or dangerous as it is. But I just think it would be much more helpful if we had more accuracy in reporting and more accuracy from politicians. Because every politician I hear now on the radio or on the television, whether they're Labour, Lib Dem, SNP or Tory, they all use this 100,000 figure as some kind of benchmark of how terrible it all is.
Well, I agree, Mike. And I think one of the things that I'd like to see a bit more transparency on is that, and we've talked about this in the past, the number of people who've gone into hospital without COVID, and obviously they're more vulnerable because they've gone in and they're ill, and they're catching the virus within hospitals. And in some weeks, that's up to like 1 in 5 of all the admissions. And then they're dying. And ultimately, that potentially is a death that could have been saved. Obviously, a lockdown doesn't really help with regards to that because you've gone in without COVID.
Well, exactly. And I think we know from the figures from last year that 26,000 people, I believe, contracted COVID in hospital since September up to December. That's a big number.
Yeah, and if you put in Wales as well and the latest few weeks, that's, you know, it's going to be well over 30,000 people now.
Yeah.
And we know they are far more vulnerable, Mike. So I think in terms of the hope now as we go forward, we've talked about the number of deaths and the age. So 83% of deaths are among people over the age of 70.
Yeah.
We've got over 12 million people had the first dose of the vaccine. Over 500,000 people have had the second dose of the vaccine. So we would be hoping now that with this vaccine rollout, with cases coming down across the country, that we're in a position where we should look to start easing some restrictions in the coming weeks. Now, I've heard a lot of people and people are kind of messaging me on Twitter as well, saying this new variant, maybe we shouldn't unlock, etc. We should continue to carry on with where we are. Now, in Wales, we've already hit the metrics. There's a basket of different metrics that you would use to decide if you reduce restrictions. Two of those have been met that we should reduce restrictions based on the kind of the government guidelines. I think if we're going to talk about kind of variants and things, we're going to be in lockdown forever because obviously we know COVID isn't going anywhere.
Right.
And ultimately, if things are improving across the country, we've got this vaccine rollout, which will reduce the pressure on the NHS. We've got to have some hope. You know, I'm a coach of a kids football team and they haven't played football, Mike, now for several months.
Right.
And they, you know, it's not good for all these children's mental health.
No. Well, I mean, my son went out and got his sledge out of the loft and went and did a bit of sledging with his mates yesterday. But that's the first time he's seen them, I think, in about 2 months.
Yeah. And it's not just the kind of the COVID deaths. They're all tragic. You know, that's one thing that we get talked about every single day. There's that other thing. And you've talked about kind of the taxes on online businesses is kind of the furlough scheme. So if we actually do kind of look at the economic effect of all of this as well, Mike. So if you look at December's data, we've got 800,000 fewer people on payrolls than we had a year earlier. So that's 800,000.
800,000. You know. See, that's nearly a million people, isn't it?
Yeah. And well, on top of that, at the same point in December, there were over 1 million people on the furlough scheme as well. So, and that's cost us at the moment about £46 billion. And hopefully we will get the economy kicking off again. But I would imagine there's going to be, sadly, some of those furlough jobs that aren't ever going to return. So we're going to probably be over 1 million people who've lost their jobs through this pandemic. And we've got to consider that aspect as well when we're thinking in terms of easing restrictions, locking down, all of that kind of stuff.
Well, of course. I mean, I know people who have contacted me on the show, but also on social media, who have had to get a new job. You know, they might have done something else other than what they're doing now, maybe a taxi driver. They're now driving a van for Amazon or driving deliveries for Sainsbury's, that kind of thing. You know, there's an awful lot of people who are not unemployed, but who have had to find another job, which might not be particularly well paid and might be much less well paid than the one they had.
Well, that is another thing that would be kind of masking some of the figures that we've got as well. In that, I've got friends of mine who've been working in kind of in the aviation industry. Yeah, no jobs there, been made redundant, and they're kind of doing some kind of part-time work just to kind of keep the family ticking over, etc. So we've got all that economic fallout, and sometimes it's easy to say, yes, we're going to lock down, we're going to have another 4 or 5 weeks in terms of all of this, but we do know that these kind of measures are having a big impact on the mental health and society. And there's not just that, there's all the other aspects now of the kind of the health service where people are not getting kind of the care that they need for other certain things. And we know people are dying from home more than average for the time of year. Maybe they're too scared to go to hospital and seek some medical advice. So I think in terms of the targets going forward, I think having an ambition of, say, zero COVID, where there's no COVID in society, I don't think that's going to be achievable. What we've got to go back to is what we had last, say, spring, is if we got the vaccine rolled out, we've got the cases coming down. So the people who would be most vulnerable, who would end up in hospital, those will start coming down with the vaccine. You then start looking in terms of, well, yeah, if younger people are going to catch the virus before we get the kind of the vaccine out, they're less likely to fall ill, less likely to die, etc. And you've got to get that balance then. You can't look for perhaps a zero COVID approach. You've got to get a balance where you've got to get society going again so that we can move forward and you know, and have a good 2021.
Well, this is it. I mean, you're supposed to be involved in risk analysis when you're a statistician and also when you're in government, which I don't appear to be doing any of. We never really hear anything about that kind of statistic in terms of, you know, what's the likelihood of something happening. All we ever hear about is a sort of worst case scenario. What if we don't do this, then something terrible will happen? Because I was going to ask you, I mean, you're former head of health analysis at the ONS, the Office of National Statistics. Did you ever collate figures on people's health in general, as opposed to just their health through the COVID pandemic? You know, like, for example, their mental health, their physical health. You know, how do we know, for example, what damage is being done to people who aren't able to go to work, who aren't able to send their kids to school, all that kind of thing?
Yeah, so there's lots of information published kind of around that. And we know that the kind of the referrals for mental health services have been going up through the pandemic. One of the kind of the tragic statistics that takes a bit more time to kind of come through is those who kind of end up sadly taking their own lives, etc. Now, we will get a better picture of that next year because there's a bit of a delay in terms of there's a coroner's inquest, etc. So, you know, I would probably just say to your listeners as well, if anybody's struggling kind of with their mental health, there's lots of people out there you can talk to and lots of charities as well. And you know, seek help if you are kind of feeling vulnerable with regards to all of that.
Well, there are. I mean, there's always people to talk to. But if there's nothing for you to do, I mean, even people that I know who are relatively sort of robust mentally are at the end of their tether at this point. They're kind of going, there's just nothing to do. You see people after the weekend, you go, what did you do? And you go, nothing. There's nothing to do.
No, it's true, Mike. And, you know, I have discussions with my friends and you say, oh, what did you do on the weekend? And yeah, it's nothing. I just stayed in the house. That's where we need this roadmap to offer some hope, because if we're going to have, if we've got 12 million people vaccinated, all the kind of the top vulnerable groups that have been vaccinated there, you'd think that we'd have some sort of roadmap to say by date X, we're going to be in this position, by date Y. I think what the government's probably worried about in that is that they've done that in the past and they've kind of been caught with their trousers down, I suppose, because they've made promises which they've had to roll back on. But if the vaccine is the hope that we've been kind of waiting for all of this time, with over 12 million people with a vaccine, you'd expect the spring as well, Mike. We know that kind of viruses tend to diminish a bit in kind of the springtime as you go towards summer. There should be a plan, I think, now that the governments in both all four countries should be able to tell us what's going to happen next.
Well, you would think so. The problem is, of course, that it is a movable feast, isn't it? And there is sometimes things that can come into the mix which you weren't expecting, like the variant that came in on December the 18th. I think people get that now. But nevertheless, it doesn't mean you can't have a plan which then might have to be altered. I mean, it's like they're talking about having to possibly slightly alter the vaccine to take care of itself against the new variant. You know, you can tweak things, you know, but to have nothing, to have no plan which you cannot tweak is really not the way forward, is it?
No, I think we do need this kind of plan in terms of where we're going to go as we go forward. You've got, for example, you know, businesses need to plan as well. People want to think about holidays. We don't know if we're going to be able to go abroad, obviously, if Europe are a bit behind on their vaccines and how that's going to affect things. And on the vaccine, Mike, you know, the COVID vaccine going forward is probably going to end up exactly like the flu vaccine. You're going to get to need to have an annual shot. They're going to need to notify you because you get different variants of the flu as well as you get different variants of COVID. So we're always going to be chasing those new variants across the world, etc. But they're not going anywhere. I think we've got to learn to kind of live with COVID with that risk-based analysis in terms of, right, what do we need to do to kind of reduce the risk to society, not just from a COVID perspective, but all other aspects of society with regards to, say, mental health, jobs, economy. We know that when people lose jobs, that has a devastating effect on their mental health and the kind of the family outcomes.
Absolutely. And looking, going back to your map that you spoke about first thing when we were speaking earlier about the sort of the one from January, which is more pink than it is yellow, and the one now, which is more yellow. Even at that, The pink is still just 10 to 20% of people testing positive who have had a COVID test. So, I mean, even when it was bad, it was 10 to 20%. Now, with the yellow and green, it's 5 to 10% and sometimes less than 5% of people testing positive. So, I mean, that is a massively big sort of indicator, it seems to me, of still small numbers of people getting infected. And of those people getting infected, an even smaller number end up going to hospital. And I know that, like I say, because we saw over 30,000 deaths in January, it's a big number, it's a big problem. I'm not diminishing it, but, you know, it's still a relatively small number compared to the numbers of people in this country.
Yeah, well, it's good news. The cases are coming down, Mike. And remember, there's that time lag that when you get kind of cases coming, going up or coming down, there's a bit of a time lag before you see the effect on hospitals. We saw a massive rise in admissions in London, for example, just before Christmas and afterwards. But as fast as they've gone up, they've actually come down just as fast as well. And they're coming down across all parts of the country. So with fewer people in a hospital, and then fewer people obviously will end up dying with regards to all of that. Those are kind of the metrics, with the vaccine as well, hopefully stopping new people going in, even if they catch it. Those are the metrics that offer those kind of hopes. And in the next few weeks, I would expect cases to continue to fall. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with the schools, Mike. We know that for many months, they said schools, there was no evidence of transmission. And they kept saying that children should be kept in school. It's better for them in the long run. They've been closed.
Which is true.
Yeah, they've been closed. And if they do starting a phased return when we get schools back, we might start seeing cases go back up if they start transmitting the virus and then taking it home. But you'd hope at that point, Mike, that the vaccine means that you might see the situation as we go forward that cases go up, but no more people go in the hospital.
Yes.
Because people will catch it. They won't be seriously ill, but we've got to live with it. And then the impact on the NHS is in there. That's what we would be hoping is going to be happening as we go forward, I think.
Well, I think that's the point, isn't it? Because if the vaccine isn't likely to make it any easier for us to move about and to get back to more normal activities, then what's the point of it? You know what I mean? If we're not using that as a means of improving our lot, then it's not a very good incentive to get it, is it?
Well, exactly. No, Mike. And the vaccine doesn't stop you catching COVID. What it will do is it just means that if you kind of get infected with the virus, the vaccine's in you and it will be able to kind of trigger off an immune response to try and attack that, which is why it doesn't stop people kind of getting seriously ill and then having a sad death at the end of it. So we're going to have cases of COVID throughout the rest of the year. We're going to have cases of COVID, you know, for the rest of our lives, because COVID is here to stay. And we know that. But it comes back to that risk-based thing now. If we've got this vaccine rolled out, we've got to get kind of the economy going at some point as well, because we need to offer that hope of all those businesses kind of across the country who just sadly haven't got any hope. They've got friends who run pubs. They want to know what's happening there. You know, they've been kind of waiting for money to come in as well. Some of the self-employed are still struggling to get money coming in as well. So I think going back to risk, we've got to look at that, balance the thing up. And it shouldn't just be all about how many infections there is. You also need to look at the economic impact as well.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Jamie, great to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed. Jamie Jenkins, former head of health analysis at the Office for National Statistics. Mike in Oxford says this on the text. You can send your text in as well to 87222. Mike, just catching up on the COVID numbers. Still basically about 20,000 more deaths than two bad seasonal flu seasons, but spread over 12 months, not two. December, January and February. I truly believe lockdowns just delay the virus and don't reduce hospitalisation and death. As lockdown numbers got increasingly worse the longer it went on, until of course maths kicked in, where you have people who've had the virus, been vaccinated, have immunity, etc., therefore less people left to become ill. I don't think we've reached those particular numbers yet, but certainly the peak, as we are now told, was January the 12th. It's been rolling downwards since then. The graph has been pointing in the right direction since then, which is a great thing. And obviously we are hopefully on the way out of it. But if the government is not going to allow the rest of the economy to be freed up, the rest of the schools to go back, because of the fact that the vaccine is out there and is being utilised by many, many more people. 12.5 million people have had it now, for heaven's sake. You know, let's get it on. This is Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Right now, though, we're going to go north of the border. Stuart Weir, a journalist based up there in Scotland, because it's a huge week for the Scottish National Party, or the Scottish Nationalist Party, as Boris Johnson likes to call them, because there's a committee hearing going on into an inquiry into Nicola Sturgeon, into what she knew, into when she knew it. Her husband, Peter Murrell, is appearing before it today. Alex Salmond, the former First Minister, is meant to appear before it tomorrow. There's some doubt as to whether he might or might not turn up because they've already ruled that he can't introduce certain pieces of evidence. It's all a bit complicated. We'll see if Stuart can untangle it all for us. Stuart, very good morning to you.
The answer to that is no. But good morning anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for those of us who had stacked up on the supply of popcorn to watch this committee gathering, I think we're going to be disappointed this week if Alex Salmond doesn't appear. It's been entertaining this morning, you would have to say, with Peter Murrell giving his evidence to such an extent, where he's maybe sort of wavered slightly from what he said previously, that the MSP Murdo Fraser challenged him and asked what he said under oath. Did he still stick by that?
Yeah.
And we now have a number of the committee members and MSPs who are frustrated at Mr. Murrell's answering of some of the questions, saying he's giving false information and basically accusing him of giving false information under oath. And of course, whereas normally that would impact on the individual, it impacts greatly, of course, in the Murrell household, as Peter Murrell is, of course, married to Nicola Sturgeon.
Well, wasn't he supposedly up before this committee last week, and then he just told them he wasn't going to bother? Thanks very much indeed, presumably under advisement from the missus. But, I mean, the point about him and what he said in the past is that he seems to have a rather woolly memory, doesn't he? As does she, because she says that she might have been in a meeting, but she can't remember what was said, and actually she forgot she was in the meeting altogether.
I think if you happen to stumble home one evening and walk into your house, and there was your wife, the current Scottish First Minister, talking to the previous Scottish First Minister, who had almost taken Scotland to independence in 2014, there might be some sort of clarity in when this took place and what was being said, but Mr. Murrell can't really decide on whether it was government business or SNP business, or whether his wife just had someone round for tea and buns.
Yeah, just to chat about the Calcutta Cup or something, which she was very happy about, of course, as I'm sure you were, as I was actually at the weekend. But this is the thing, right? The argument seems to be about, and this is where people start to sort of lose interest when you start to try and explain precisely what the argument is about. The argument is about her contending that she found out about something later than she actually did. And if that's true, then it means that she's misled Parliament.
Yeah, absolutely. And people are now picking up on that. There is a... We are not talking here, Mike, about a matter of hours or days. We are talking about a sizable chunk of the calendar between when she said she first found out and also how she testified and other evidence that came out as to when she actually did know. And that void has to be filled by something. And a lot of people are now saying, you know, that she has been at best economical with the truth. And it would be it's difficult to tie her down. I noticed in your social media, on your tweet, you were talking about the net tightens on Nicola Sturgeon.
Yeah.
I think we're getting to the stage where we're probably going to arm ourselves with a harpoon gun if we are really going to tie her down to remembering these kind of things. She can't, you know, what she might have said, who she said it to. It's all becoming very convoluted and very confused.
But an awful lot of observers in Scotland and columnists have already said that this particular inquiry is not really worth the paper it's written on, because it's not particularly independent, and it certainly isn't about to hear the evidence that Alex Salmond wants it to hear, which is why he may not show up tomorrow. And many are calling for a completely independent inquiry, which would actually get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, but then again, I think if you ask for a completely independent inquiry, you would then have people picking and choosing who would look into these matters. I think it's very difficult in Scotland just now to get anything that's independent. Some would say even a country that's independent.
Yeah.
But I think just now, if you looked at yesterday's newspaper, the front page of, I think, the Sunday Post, it was, who pictured all of the committee members and basically put the headline and the strapline: misled, obstructed, divided and racing the clock. Salmond inquiry, MSPs reveal an investigation in crisis. And the fact that they're at this stage means the whole thing could collapse. And if it does collapse, people won't say there is something to hide. people will say it wasn't worth doing it in the first place, so therefore continue as normal.
Yes, I suppose that might be what they're doing. But when you look at Murdo Fraser, you mentioned him earlier, who was questioning Peter Murrell, he's tweeted this, right? Giving a false statement under oath is a criminal offence under Section 44(1) of the Criminal Law Consolidation Scotland Act 1995. It is clear from his evidence today that Peter Murrell is guilty of this offence. So what that effectively is like saying, it's a bit like saying that basically Boris Johnson's wife, if he had one, or his partner, is guilty of lying to the parliamentary committee, right? I mean, it seems extraordinary, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, I mean, I keep picturing, remember the sketches that Morecambe and Wise used to have when the two of them are sitting in bed in their striped pyjamas, basically saying, and what are you doing tomorrow, dear?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to be learning this text or this script so that I don't drop you in it from a great height.
Right.
And that is entirely what it looks like.
It really does. So, I mean, as far as the stuff that is not being allowed to be discussed tomorrow, which is why Alex Salmond says he may not show up, what is that exactly?
Well, Alex Salmond, he obviously has evidence that he wanted to expose. It's been in the hands of, you know, various solicitors and, of course, with the committee. He has recently, in fact, within about the last half hour, his lawyers have released another statement saying, asking a witness to accept the constraints of speaking only to evidence selected by you on the undisclosed advice and direction of unidentified others is not acceptable in any forum and is, in our client's view, particularly offensive when the remit he seeks to address has been set out by Parliament and addressed the unlawful actions of an elected government. I mean, that is as much as you can lay the boot into somebody on a Monday morning and still get away with it. I think what he's going to do is come out, if he had the opportunity, and basically open up his diary as to what was said and who said it. Mm. And if he does that, then I think the spotlight certainly focuses in on Nicola Sturgeon.
Yeah, it's certainly something she could do without. You know, it's very clear that down here now in London, there's a much bigger and sharper focus on whether Nicola Sturgeon is actually doing the job that she convinces everybody that she seems to be doing. And there's a lot more doubt now being cast on her future and her longevity even as the head of the SNP. Because whichever way this goes, this is not a good situation for her.
Yeah, any strategist would tell you, a military strategist would tell you, you should only fight on one front at a time. Most people, most politicians in the UK are fighting COVID just now and looking for, you know, to cure COVID and stave off the threat of the pandemic. However, she's managed to open up several fronts. You have the Salmond inquiry. You have our own domestic inquiry that's probably taking place as well. You have the shambles of the vaccinations in Scotland, where we were promised a million people would be vaccinated by the 1st of February, and we fell 400,000 short on that. Mm. You know, there are so many other issues in so many other areas. And above all, she's also fighting probably her own membership within the SNP, having said, yeah, we will have another independence referendum in 2021.
Yeah.
Personally, I don't think a great many people have a stomach for that, and a great many people will be casting doubt on that as well, and the validity of that, given the fact that she can't do her day job.
Well, that's the thing. And also, on top of the Joanna Cherry story from last week, where she got fired from the front bench because of her disagreements with the leadership and her friendship with Alex Salmond, there's another MP, SNP MP, I believe, who's added some money to a crowdfunding page for somebody else who's suing a different SNP MP.
Yes.
I mean, talk about, you know, trouble at mill. It really is like a sort of party eating itself.
To use the military analogy again, I think that would qualify as blue on blue, or
yes,
in the case of the SNP, yellow on yellow.
Right.
And I mean, there is a real chasm growing within the SNP, so much so that one or two experts are predicting that it could be the breakup of the SNP as we know it, which would see two independence parties. Now, whether that would dilute the membership and dilute the strength of the vote for independence, I'm not quite sure. Given the way that Holyrood is elected and you have multiple votes, it might actually strengthen their hand. And, you know, being the skeptic I am on a number of things, I would say that there might be some Machiavellian plotting going on in the background, that's exactly what one or two are actually looking for.
Absolutely right. And obviously they're going ahead with the elections, despite the fact that in Scotland, I think at the moment, you're not actually allowed to go outside your front garden, are you?
No, you're not. In fact, you're not allowed to stay in the same house as the people that you stay in the house with.
How are they going to run an election then?
It's terribly contrived. I mean, I heard someone saying, and you'll have to take your own pencil. Getting out the front door in Scotland's a bigger challenge. So, I think on one hand, we're being told this lockdown isn't for easing. And on the other hand, it might be a bit like Christmas Day. Mm. You might be allowed out just to vote, but make sure you put your tick in the right box.
As long as you vote for the SNP, we'll let you out of your house. I mean, it's not funny, but I mean, it's almost that bad, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm now wondering what Romania was like in the 1980s.
Well, I mean, what is it actually like there? Because, I mean, down here, people are getting pretty fed up, even though, London is reasonably busy. Most parts of the country are not. And an awful lot of bits of London are not particularly. But, I mean, you guys have been in a much stricter lockdown for longer, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. I mean, just before Christmas, I physically had to go to the bank and walking through city centre in Glasgow, through George Square, from where the old Evening Times offices used to be, you'd be familiar with that, to Gordon Street, which is right next to Central Station. And I walked there and back at around 3 o'clock on a Monday afternoon, and I passed 17 people.
Wow. That's extraordinary, isn't it?
If there was any Hollywood studios out there wanting to come back to Glasgow and do some shooting, now is the time to do it, because there's absolutely nobody around. It is so quiet. And the other thing is, Mike, it's not as if the buildings are just sitting there waiting for people, to open the doors. So many of the pubs and restaurants are actually boarded up. Mm. Okay, that's to protect what's inside, but it gives a really spooky and a really eerie feeling to the centre of Glasgow, when you know what a vibrant hub that is, given the fact you've got two major train stations almost side by side, given the fact you've got some fantastic shopping areas within Glasgow. Glasgow ain't what it used to be.
No. Well, nowhere is at the moment. That's the trouble. Stuart, good to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed. We'll keep an eye on developments throughout this week, I'm sure. Peter Murrell, giving evidence today, has been accused of basically making a false statement by a Tory MSP. That's the husband of the First Minister of Scotland, who has now been accused of making a false statement under oath, a criminal offence. That's where this is going, ladies and gentlemen.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, it's a very cold Monday morning. Time to say a very good morning to Mr. Peter Hitchens. Peter, how are you?
Well, okay. My brakes froze on my bicycle this morning, but frozen, so here I am.
What happens when that happens? I didn't see many cyclists out this morning.
You become totally immobile. That's what happens. And then you turn the bicycle upside down and fiddle with it, and then you release it. But it's quite alarming.
Well, I must admit, I'd be a bit wary of black ice and that kind of thing, wouldn't you?
Yes. Well, you can't use cycle paths and things like that. You have to stick to the main roads because they've been gritted.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I did wonder about that, actually, because the cyclist I did see on the way in was on the road, and I was about to suggest to him that he moved to the cycleway, but maybe that was the reason.
Well, that is the reason, and a lot of cyclists are either not going out, or if they are out, then they have to use the main roads, because very few authorities actually bother to grit or clear cycle tracks. They just don't seem to think it matters, although they all pose as being cycle-friendly. They aren't really.
Right, yeah. Well, I seem to remember as well, they built one of the cycle superhighways, as they call it, rather laughably, in London, and it was made with such a slippery material that they had to rip it all up again because cyclists were coming around, I think it was Vauxhall Bridge or somewhere, and just sliding off the cycle path because it was so slippery.
That's completely credible. What local authorities do tend to do is they design these cycle paths which are visible from the moon, but which suddenly stop in the middle of nowhere or turn into car parks.
Yeah.
They're doing it to fulfill quotas rather than because they really either understand the problem or believe what they're saying. It's a pity, because if more people did it, we'd have a much healthier population and a much happier one. But alas, everything is designed around the car still. So quite reasonably, car drivers get annoyed about having to make way for cyclists and stuff like that. And I blame them. Because the thing is never really very intelligently done.
Well, that's the trouble. And I mean, my argument with those who do these things is as well that what they're actually doing is creating more congestion, not less, by all of the measures that they put into place. And they don't give any incentive, really, to anybody to not drive, quite frankly.
No, completely not. I mean, it's very hard the way the world is arranged at the moment, particularly for those people who have to take children to nurseries, go on to a place of work. To travel by any other means than the car. The whole way of life is designed around the car. A lot of people drive cars not because they want to or they like it, but because they have to. Mm. And there's absolutely no point making life more difficult for them. It's not going to stop them driving cars. It's just going to make them annoyed.
Yes.
I just think we should redesign our cities and indeed our countryside around a different form of transport. But ever since the Beeching report of the 1960s, it's been car, car, car. The Ministry for Transport is the Ministry for Cars.
Yes, well, quite. But that's another story for another day, I suppose, because once again, you may well be accused again of talking common sense and or demanding evidence, which, of course, you were accused of at the weekend.
You mustn't do that. No, you're treated with immense suspicion and hostility. There's some academic posted things saying, well, the reason why flu has disappeared is that the flu is so much, infections of flu are so much less virulent than those of a virus. Because I was asking her exactly why it was that the flu had virtually disappeared and COVID hadn't. And the standard response to this is that everybody's been following the social distancing and...
Yes.
Well, if it works against flu, why doesn't it work in exactly the same way against COVID?
Well, exactly right.
And this well, they have different infection rates. So I said, okay, well, thanks very much. But can you point me to where this is explained?
Hmm.
And that was the point at which I began to be treated as if I was some kind of vandal who'd put a brick through a window. And I was told I should have Googled it. I said, well, you said it.
Right.
The other one, so I'm constantly accused of claiming to have of having theories about the outbreak. I don't have any theories about it. I'm just because I'm not equipped to do so. I'm just skeptical about a lot of the things which authority and the majority of the media say, and think they should be tested.
Yeah.
And this increasingly gets me. I was the noted author of anti-God children's books, Philip Pullman. Was having a go at me at the weekend.
I saw that, yeah.
Insinuating that I had said things which had led to the doctors being insulted. I've never said anything which would suggest that doctors were insulted, and why would I?
No. Well, but this is a new tactic, Peter, that they've brought in.
It's just a smear. Sir Philip himself, people should look this up, has an interesting record on Twitter. which doesn't really put him in a very good position for berating me. But I mean, it is over and over again this suggestion that things that I've said or done have led to bad behaviour by people which I've not encouraged, or deaths in which I've had no part. And it's I accept that the other side have a good intentions and a reasonable point of view. And I start from the position, okay, then if let's discuss this rationally. And this to begin with, this was met by either blank hostility or silence. Now it's being met with a much more worrying thing, which is an attempt to shut me and others up by guilt by association smears. And it's serious. If you have a society without opposition, then you get the Iraq War, and you get thalidomide being given to pregnant women, and you get all kinds of mistakes being made because opposition is vital to the proper consideration of policy decisions. And a fascinating thing which Jonathan Sumption, Lord Sumption, wrote in the Mail on Sunday yesterday, which is well worth examining, which is he pointed out that there was actually quite serious contingency planning for a major pandemic of a respiratory disease. Plans existed, and they didn't remotely resemble what we did, but they were just chucked aside in a moment in that extraordinary week of panic in late March. But we did have a plan, and it was based on decades of experience, the sort of thing which civil servants are expert in drawing out. But it was just chucked away, and we decided to copy China instead. And this is the most extraordinary revelation. Now, people should realize that there always has been an alternative approach, which is perfectly serious, perfectly humane, just as concerned about saving life as the closure of our society, and that it existed and was discarded.
Yes, I think that he also suggests that the government was spooked by what they saw going on in Italy, not least by the sort of the, and we've talked about this before, you and I, the sort of the numbers of lorries turning up, the video pictures of inside hospitals where there were bodies just literally piled up everywhere, and I think that really really spooked them because it did look an awful situation. But we've never had that situation, and we never did have it, and it wasn't because we locked it down; it was just because it just didn't happen.
No, it's also the regrettable truth that a lot of things go on in our society which don't tend to get filmed most of the time, which, if they were filmed, would make people very distressed. And I think that it's essential to realise that a lot of the difference lies in the coverage and the intensity of interest in it, which makes it seem, I won't say worse than it is, but it certainly makes it seem very worrying. And people are afraid of disease and death, with perfectly good reason. And if they're given a constant diet of disease and death on their television screens and in their newspapers, then they will become worried. It will change their behaviour and their way of thinking. I just think that people should be a bit more cautious about the way in which these things are done, and also a bit more cautious in the way in which they respond to media coverage. That's asking more, though, I have to say. The power of seeing a chaotic hospital with people running and shouting and people dying or a huge Coffinfield morgue on the screen. The power of that on the mind is vast.
Yes. Well, it's similar to something that happens every time there's an air crash. It doesn't happen so much anymore because there aren't so many air crashes. But I always remember when I was in newspapers, and you still are, obviously, Peter, whenever there was an air crash, you would suddenly have a flurry of reports of near misses. And suddenly that would make it into the papers for about a week. And everyone would say, yeah, but this happens every day. There's a near miss practically every day. It only really gets reported in the wake of an air crash.
Indeed. And it's also the case with train crashes, which are terrible things. Large numbers of people die at once. But in fact, the railways remain extraordinarily safe. But the thing is that train crashes, when they happen, the numbers of dead are large. The aerial pictures of the concertina train are dramatic and frightening. But in fact, if we covered road crashes in the same way, it would rapidly become clear that roads are far more dangerous than trains. But in fact, the coverage continues to suggest that trains are terribly, terribly dangerous, and train crashes happen a lot, which is it's just the way in which the media operates means that these misleading estimates of the importance of events, the context of them, are actually far too common. It's a major fault
Yes, it is. But I'll tell you what, I'll try harder to correct. Yeah, what I find slightly more disturbing is what you mentioned there about Philip Pullman and others who have now started to use as a tactic this kind of blame game where they say that what you say is dangerous and it has this terrible effect. I mean, he is a guy, I know you don't want to say it, but I will say it, who I pointed out, I think, on your Twitter feed, once called for the lynching of the Prime Minister. You know, so his idea of you somehow inciting other people is rather ironic for a start.
I should say he says that's not what he was doing, but he did take the tweet down. So yes. I think he's more silly than anything else.
Yes.
I've criticised his books, and I think he doesn't really like that very much.
Well, I mean, he's also written about what a terrible country Britain is, which is a country which has made him rather wealthy, not least by providing him with large funds of money for the BBC.
Well, indeed, but let's not enter into the strange world of
No, let's not.
Well, Sir Philip Pullman, as I think we should stress. His title.
Yes, indeed. Because I've had the same, funnily enough, because I do occasionally get into rows with cyclists on Twitter, and they accuse me of creating an atmosphere where cyclists can be harmed by motorists because I'm anti-cyclist, which I'm not. But I ask for cyclists to behave as they would if they were driving a car and try to adhere to the rules as best they can and not go through red lights.
I would say there is, I mean, this is not new, but I would say there is exaggerated hostility on the part of some motorists towards cyclists. And if ever you get into any sort of altercation, invariably someone will say to you, but you don't pay road tax, to which I respond, well, actually, I pay an enormous amount of tax towards the road, because I pay a lot of income tax, and there is no such thing as road tax as it happens. But that idea has been spread, that cyclists can free ride on expensive roads made for them. On the other hand, I would completely side with those people who say an awful lot of cyclists just break the rules all the time. But some of these things do make for hostility. I'm not saying anybody's been killed as a result of it, but I think you can create unnecessary hostility if you... But I would challenge anybody to say that anything that I said has ever encouraged anybody to be rude to a hard working doctor in the middle of a outbreak of disease, because it wouldn't even ever occur to me. What would be the point?
No, of course. I was speaking to a statistician this morning, Jamie Jenkins, who used to be at the ONS, and I said to him, you know, it's not as though any of us don't believe this to be a serious pandemic or a serious disease or a serious virus. It's not that. It's just that we want accountability and honesty from the politicians. And whenever I now hear this 100,000 figure dead being trotted out, it's as if nobody now questions it. Nobody says, as I said to him this morning, is it not possible that some of those people who have had a COVID positive test in the last 28 days before they died, is it not possible that they did not die of COVID? And it is, and he conceded that it was possible. And so the 100,000, you know, so I'd much rather have a proper figure of what the so-called excess deaths are, and that would be more honest, I think.
Well, completely. And the 100,000 figure is interesting. But again, I can't say, because I have no means of knowing. I can't say the figure is inaccurate or misleading. I can say, however, that the way in which the figures are gathered and recorded makes it perfectly possible that there is an overestimate here. And I say again and again that right back in April, Dr. Jenny Harris, one of the deputy chief medical officers, made this very point at a government press conference. Dying with and dying of are not the same thing. And I have to say, we've seen much less of Dr. Harris than of the other deputy chief medical officer or the other medical officers since she said that. But that probably is completely coincidental.
Well, it may well be. But it is interesting, isn't it, that we're getting a message now that's coming quite loud and clear through certain avenues, shall we say, of the press, that Boris Johnson wants to lift the lockdown more. However, he's being sort of stymied from doing so by the science and by the scientists, almost as if he's being held hostage.
The scientists have one responsibility, and it is to constantly stress the dangers which can be avoided by taking certain precautions. They have no wider responsibilities at all. They don't have to worry about whether the actions which they propose or defend have collateral effects on cancer treatment, heart disease, or anything else. Although they don't have to worry about the fact, they're never even asked to consider the effects of these things upon the old living on their own, upon divided families, and the other demoralizing things, which I believe are actually making quite a lot of people ill. They don't have to, and they're not elected, they don't have to go before the public. They have one responsibility, because the other thing is, if they get it wrong, and if they offer advice which then leads, which when taken then leads to bad things, then they face blame for it. And one of the problems about making restrictions, and this is my great metaphor, this isn't even really a metaphor, is Margaret Thatcher's gates in Downing Street. And there they are. Mm. They were put up because of some alleged threat that Hezbollah was going to come driving up Downing Street with a lorry load of explosives about 20 years ago. And they will never, ever move. Mm. Because no one will ever, no expert, no security chief will ever say these gates should go. Because if in any time period from 6 months to 60 years afterwards, Hezbollah eventually do turn up with a lorry load of explosives, then that person will be blamed for having taken the gates away. And that's the problem with restrictions. Once you put them in place, no one will take responsibility for removing them. That requires political courage.
And also, there's no question, I don't think, that some of these people who work in public health, and I use that almost as though it's the same as the distinction between with COVID and of COVID, because working in public health doesn't necessarily make you an expert in health. You don't have to be one. You can be a behavioural scientist. You can be somebody who's written a couple of, you know, interesting dissertations about people and how they relate to illness. It doesn't have to be that you're a doctor. And I think these are people who live their lives, or at least maybe they don't live their lives this way, but they make out that we should all live our lives avoiding as much risk as possible. And some people don't want to live like that.
Well, they're utopians. They have, as a good friend of mine keeps pointing out, they've decided we should live in a new Jerusalem of total safety.
Mm.
And it sounds quite attractive. You think, well, no risk. Death pushed to the very margins of society, disease reduced to the minimum. Well, actually, we've done a heck of a lot to do that in the past 20 or 30 years, which is why so many more people are living so much longer.
Mm.
But if you take it beyond a certain point where life has to be so restricted as the price for it, then many people say, well, actually, do I want to live in this new Jerusalem? I quite like the old Jerusalem, thank you very much, or indeed the old Wolverhampton. I don't want to be there, but there's never been an election in which somebody has sort of said, look, what we've decided to do and what we, if we're in government, we will do is create a society in which you are so safe that actually you can't leave your homes for large periods of the year. You're constantly washing and sanitizing yourself. You can't mix with people. The pubs all have to close. Lots of industries have to close. Foreign travel becomes an impossibly expensive and difficult enterprise. If people were given this option, they might say, well, actually, I might prefer a little bit more risk and a bit less restriction. But no one's ever offered them this choice.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, I lived in New York in the 80s, and it was slightly grubby, quite dangerous, thrilling, and an incredible city. Now it's just another city, because Rudolf Giuliani kind of ruined it by making it completely and utterly for a crime free. He got rid of the mafia, he got rid of the insider trading on Wall Street, he got rid of the hot dog sellers. And I was in a taxi once, and the guy says, why is he getting rid of that? This is New York, it's not Salt Lake City. But he's kind of turned into Salt Lake City.
I'm not sure. I'm slightly with Giuliani there, having got in the late 70s. Wandered into the wrong part of town after dark, and sincerely wished that I hadn't. I'm quite in favour of making New York a bit more crime-free. And it wasn't always a dump of crime. I think that in the era before, really, the late 60s and 70s, it was quite a well-policed city, and it suddenly went down this spiral. So I'm not entirely sure I'd go with you there, Mike. I think there are some risks I'm quite keen on.
I know what you mean, but I find it it's like Disneyland. I mean, I used to go to 42nd Street in Times Square, which was an absolute kind of ghastly, debauched place full of crackheads, hookers, porn theatres, and that kind of thing. And now it's like Disneyland, and somehow it doesn't work for me.
No, well, I can see that. But I think other people would say, well, maybe there's a price to be paid for having an orderly city where people are safe from being mugged and burgled and where drug abuse is discouraged and things like that. So I wouldn't. There is obviously a point, and you and I disagree about it, exactly where the intervention of the law and the state should begin. But I think that the level of restriction under which we currently live, and may, it seems to me, live for some time to come, goes a lot further than a police crackdown on porn and drugs and muggers. This is the restriction of the law abiding and the narrowing of life to such an extent that we may be safe, but safe to do what? Yeah. We're alive but not living.
Yes, I think that's very true. Peter, we're out of time, sadly, but we will be reconvening on Wednesday with you and Dan Hodges, head-to-head, I think we're going to call it. Hopefully that will go well, and we'll be recording that for a publication and broadcast a little bit later on this week. Peter Hitchens, Mail on Sunday columnist.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham, Cork Radio.
Let us say a very good afternoon to Hugh Pennington, Professor of Bacteriology at Aberdeen University. Hugh, a very good afternoon to you.
Hi there.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. Why suddenly do you think there is this kind of, hesitance, I suppose, would be the best way to describe it, after writing the Daily Telegraph, Nadeem Zahawi says the vaccines being used in Britain work terribly well against the COVID-19 variants currently dominant in the UK. But he's had to say that because it's been suggested that it doesn't.
Well, a small study in South Africa, about 2,000 people, has basically shown that what the AstraZeneca vaccine doesn't do is protect them against mild illness, which is really quite different from protecting against, you know, being hospitalised, going into ICU, and actually, not to put too fine a point, it being killed by the virus. Because, you know, the vaccine really works in two ways. One is to stop a serious infection, and there's no evidence that it doesn't do that, and all the evidence we have suggests that it will do that reasonably well. But stopping the virus growing in your nose and causing mild symptoms is really quite different, and there's been quite a lot of argument about that, whether any of the vaccines do that, and the evidence for that is not yet at all clear. And then maybe they don't do it terribly well. So they don't stop the virus spreading, but they stop when the virus infects somebody, the virus getting into, you know, organs like the lungs and other organs in the body and causing the serious infections, which, you know, essentially can kill people. And all the evidence that we have to date suggests that the vaccines do that. They prevent the severe infection, but they may not be very good at preventing the virus actually growing, you know, basically up in the nose and the back of the throat.
So, yes.
Clearly what we have to wait for is much more definitive evidence on that. But my expectation is that the vaccines, any of them, all of them, will work against reducing, if not preventing completely, these very serious infections, but they may not be so good at stopping the virus getting about.
Yes, I think one of the problems, Professor, that we have at the moment in the world is that the media is so keen to get a new story every single day about something which is essentially not really changing that much at the moment, that they sort of give more importance to stories like this than they probably should. I mean, it's on the front page pretty much of most newspapers today, that we should be keeping faith with this jab. But as you've just rather eloquently explained, it's a very small study in a different country, which may or may not be correct.
That's right. And yes, the media is very exercised about this. It has been for several weeks now about the variants and the mutants and sort of Frankenstein not being mentioned by name, but, you know, being lurking there in the back of people's minds and all that kind of stuff. Now, entirely to be expected that we get these mutants, because we know that these viruses, we know coronaviruses mutate quite a lot. Maybe not quite as much as flu, but not far off. And we know with flu, every year you have to have a different, well, not every year you have to have a different vaccine, but every year we look at the viruses that are buzzing about and change the vaccines if we think that the vaccines need to be changed. And that's one thing that, for example, the Oxford group says, yes, they're on top of this, and if they need to change the vaccine, they can do it quite quickly. It's much easier to do the first part, you know, the actual...
To actually get the vaccine and then tweak it, yeah.
To grow it, because you have to make, you know, quite a lot of it and get it tested, and, you know, the regulators have to be certain that everything is going away. And one of the big problems, I think, has been getting it into little bottles, not making it, but, you know, dispensing it, as it were. You know, that's pretty common sense. You can work that out. But nevertheless, they're in a position to, if there's a need to change the vaccine to make it stronger, it can be done really quite quickly in terms of changing the actual vaccine. And it will be the same essential vaccine as the one that's been been rolled out. Mm. You know, the basic composition is the same, so there won't be need for endless sort of regulatory kind of approval, so waiting months and months and months and months to do that. So I'm really quite optimistic that the vaccine itself, as it stands, will give protection. But if as more mutants appear, which is entirely to be expected, we don't know what they're going to do. Some might be even milder, you know, in terms of what they do to people than the current virus, because that's been the examples. There are examples of that with other coronaviruses in causing animal disease. But never mind. One can't bank on that. One has to assume and be prepared for the virus changing in a way that might make the vaccines significantly less effective. And we can cope with that. And even the vaccines that have been rolled out, even if a new mutant appears that is really very different, the immunity that the current vaccines have given will act as a kind of backstop. They'll be there, and that will be stimulated by any new vaccine as well. So I'm really quite optimistic that we're going down the right track, and that basically there's certainly no need to panic at all. That the vaccines that have been rolled out in the UK are very protective against all the viruses that are buzzing around at the moment. We know that. Obviously, one question is how well the South African variant will do. Will it compete with the British variant or not? Because the British variant has got quite common, but that one is we're protected by the current vaccines against that one. So I'm optimistic that we will get on top of the virus using the vaccine approach. We'll still have to have the social distancing, I'm afraid, for quite a time to come, because even the vaccine itself, even if it was 100% effective, not everybody's going to take it. And a few people won't make as good an immune response, because that's the way vaccines work. Most people make a good immune response, but not everybody, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's right.
Even then, we'll have to have some social distancing going on until we've got the virus levels right down.
I was talking to a caller earlier on, Eric, I think it was in Shropshire, who was talking about being in the music business and the problems for people who are in the entertainment business in general. Being told by people at Sage, well, of course, you know, Glastonbury's not going to go on for several years. You're not going to be able to have gatherings of mass numbers of people in any way, shape or form, whether it's a theatre, whether it's a sports event, whether it's a concert of some description. And I think there seems to be two schools of thought at the moment, Hugh. There's one from Sage which says, you know, that's what we have to do and we have to keep these people apart. Or there's the other school which says, look, if we are going to have to live with this virus, we're going to need to find a better way of doing it, which doesn't involve bankrupting, you know, millions of people and preventing thousands and thousands of people from working.
Well, my own view is that knowing what other coronaviruses have done in the past, and particularly SARS, which we had quite a bit, you know, we had a bad time with it, 2002, but we got rid of the bloody thing. Mm. We got rid of it completely. And I think there's a real prospect. I'm not making any predictions, but there's a real prospect.
We could do the same.
We could get the levels down so low that basically, as long as we have a good contact tracing system, we can jump on in little outbreaks, because they might be quite big, but they'll be very localized. And we can control that, I think we can then pretty well go back to normal for everything else. And that there might have to be some travel restrictions on countries that haven't done as well as we have in controlling the virus. I mean, that is basically what happened with smallpox in the olden days. You know, it was still buzzing around in other countries, and we had the occasional outbreak, imported cases, but we managed to cope very well by having, you know, a very good system to do that. And I think that my own view is that'll be the situation we're in the not too distant future with COVID, and that the music industry and pubs and, you know, going to restaurants and going to football matches will be back to pretty well where we were before.
Yes. I mean, what about the situation of the delayed vaccine? Because I see there's a piece today quoting David Nabarro from the World Health Organization. This is another thing that there was a sort of a dual and two different opinions about, whether it was better to vaccinate more people first with one vaccine than it was to multiply the numbers of vaccines that were given to people. And the 12 weeks, which it now is, rather than the 3 weeks, which originally it was going to be, the World Health Organization now saying that might be the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, we basically have to use the vaccines that are available. There's a whole raft of different ones that are available, and that basically they all work in pretty well the same way. They all stimulate, you know, an immune response against, mostly against the spike protein, but some are broader than that. And basically, you know, that's the aim of the exercise with the vaccines. It doesn't matter which one you've got. If you've got immunity against your spike protein, that's going to stop the virus doing much mischief. It might even stop it growing altogether. Mm. And even putting two different vaccines, one first and another one second, might work quite well. And we know that immune system, we know enough about how immune systems work to be really quite optimistic that that will work fine. And basically, as long as we use the vaccines that are being produced in the most effective way, and I think the most effective way is the way we're doing it in the UK, where, you know, we're getting as many people vaccinated as possible to get the virus sort of numbers of severe cases down as far as possible. That's basically saving lives. And then we can start worrying a bit later about vaccinating the whole population, and because we're not into that phase yet at all, which will actually have more of an effect on stopping the virus having a target to hit, as it were, because people will be immune and, you know, they won't get the virus to the level that they can then spread it on. Even if the virus does continue for a while, then we also have to think about other things about controlling outbreaks, because this virus specializes in causing outbreaks. And we identify those outbreaks, put a sort of ring around them, you know, and that doesn't take very long, actually. And that's how we've worked with other infectious agents, and we worked very successfully with it. And the example I keep on going back to is smallpox, which was very similar in many ways to this virus, although it was easier to diagnose because you got spots, and there wasn't the sort of asymptomatic thing, which is the real bugbear with this virus, that people can be infected without knowing they're infected, but can be infectious and spread the virus on. That's the bugbear, and that's why we have to have a very good testing system to spot those people and so on. So the more testing we do, and the more ability we have to control outbreaks, the sooner the virus will die out. And that is my hope. I'm not making a prediction, because, you know...
No, that's a very dangerous business, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, I'm not expecting you to make any predictions, but what I would ask you, Hugh, is in terms of the way that the numbers are falling at the moment, we're told that the peak was probably January the 12th. I'm wondering, in a normal kind of winter time period, what sorts of sort of pressures are highest and when? Is it during the first 2 weeks of January that's usually worst, and does it then improve from that point on in terms of NHS bed occupancy and that kind of thing?
Yeah, by analogy with flu, that's what we would expect, that January is the peak of the flu season, and we don't really know why flu gets calmer in the winter, but all we know is that it does. And, it's to do with the climate and people staying more inside than, you know, they would do in the summer and all that kind of thing. And we know that January is the peak time for that. And then it cools off from the virus point of view, you know, in February and March. We enter a much quieter time. And the expectation is, and this was a prediction that was made, you know, last summer, that this is what would happen with this virus, and it's what's happening with this virus. Mm. You know, it's got colder in winter, as was predicted, for the same sort of reasons, whatever they are, that flu gets busy in January. And then as the weather...
Although apparently this year it hasn't done, and we're told that flu hasn't really affected people as much this year, and certainly there haven't been any flu deaths this year, and we're told that might be because of the COVID restrictions. But by the same token, we're also told that COVID is still spreading because people aren't obeying the law.
Well, yes. I mean, there are differences there. But, you know, flu is a law unto itself. And some years are bad and some years are not bad. And this year is definitely the quietest flu year, I think, on record. And it was 6 months ago in New Zealand and Chile and Australia as well. So it's utterly predictable that we would have a very, very quiet, almost zero flu season this year, because of people wearing masks and, you know, socially distancing and all that. which obviously has had a bigger effect on flu than it has on COVID, because COVID gets around very, 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 very easily. And obviously, I think at the end of the day, we'll work out that, yes, it gets around a lot easier than flu does. There aren't that many asymptomatic infections with flu, for example. And, of course, the flu does affect people in a very different way. Like, for example, schools were a very, very big sort of factor in spread of flu, but they're not in COVID. You know, although they may play a role, it's a much less important role with COVID than it is with flu. So there are quite big sort of epidemiological differences between the viruses, but the seasonal effect has definitely been there, you know. And as I said, we don't really know. We can't give a simple explanation why is that with flu. Neither can we with COVID. But the prediction that COVID would take off and get much easier, have a much easier ride and spread more rapidly in the winter has been borne out in practice.
I've got a message here from Keith, who's texted or tweeted in, rather, a question for you. The common cold versus the COVID virus. Would current measures reduce the likelihood of the common cold, and which is the most transmittable?
Well, yes. I mean, there are people still getting colds. And, you know, there are subtle differences between all these viruses. Who has them? Which age groups get them? Which age groups are good at spreading, as I've just said, with the flu?
Mm.
And I think that comes into it. And at the end of the day, you know, this is where the mathematical models will have to get to work and work out exactly what factors have been the important factors in terms of determining whether a particular virus spread by the respiratory route. Because a lot of it depends on other factors like how much virus does an individual excrete, and basically how long are they infectious, and all that kind of thing, and how important things are, these fomites, which are, you know, surfaces that you touch and all that. And we don't really know enough about COVID to know exactly what are the really important things there. And we still have a bit of mystery sometimes with common colds. Mm. After all, we used to have a common cold research unit on Salisbury Plain. Closed that many years ago because we thought, well, the problem is so trivial, let's not bother about doing the science on it. So the science of the common cold, there are still many unanswered questions there. But certainly I know from personal experience and friends and so on that colds are still buzzing around, unlike the flu. And that's a very interesting scientific question. It doesn't help us very much with COVID, except that we know that COVID has got common in the winter, as was predicted.
Yes, right. And I presume that common cold virus or whatever it is, germs, actually live out on surfaces in the same way that COVID can.
Well, yes. I mean, some common cold viruses are more resistant to that. And COVID is quite a delicate virus in the sense that once it's dried, it's dead, whereas some common cold virus, not all, because some common cold viruses are coronaviruses, quite different, you know, quite different from COVID, but they're quite sort of easily affected by drying and ultraviolet light, whereas other cold viruses are much tougher, a bit more like the old enemy, the norovirus, which is very, very, very tough indeed.
That is. And you don't want to get that anytime soon.
Survive on surfaces for weeks and months.
I haven't actually heard of a norovirus this winter. Normally there is one, but that may be because nobody's at school. Because I always remember when I had young children, there was always somebody with it in a primary school.
Yes, that's right. Well, of course, you know, it's been a big challenge for the health services, norovirus, because once you get it into a hospital ward, it can spread like wildfire. But obviously, well, my guess is that the sort of things that we've been doing to prevent COVID spreading in hospitals have also had a negative effect on the virus, on norovirus. And of course, one classical norovirus situation was cruise liners. Well, there aren't any cruise liners cruising at the moment, so that's one area of the norovirus's sort of happy time that it is not there. So, you know, there are factors like that one has to bear in mind with the norovirus that basically, you know, that's also been affected by the hospital. But, of course, the hospital situation has been turned upside down by the coronavirus because so many patients are in hospital with that and relatively fewer patients with other more traditional conditions that hospitals specialise in, like cancer treatment and treating heart disease and all that kind of thing.
Absolutely right. Professor Hugh Pennington, thank you very much indeed. Emeritus Professor of Bacteriology at Aberdeen University, talking to us about the common cold, norovirus as well, which is a really nasty thing. But also, he's got the right idea, in my view, that you cannot expect COVID to just disappear altogether. However, it may well do. And whatever it is that the vaccine does for the moment should help that happen. And I think that's what we should all hope that is the case, because then by the time we get to Easter, we've already been told last week by Boris Johnson that by the time we get to March the 8th, it could be the schools are opening. And by the time we get to the end of March, it could be that things are looking an awful lot better than they are now.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. It is that time of the day because, of course, we just had the news at 12:30. We will be filming Plank of the Week later on this week, tomorrow actually, with Dawn Neesman and Kevin O'Sullivan. There's already quite a few people put their names forward inadvertently by doing something particularly plankish. And I'm about to do something now, which you perhaps might say is potentially exactly that. Emma Louise Rose is a teacher, team leader at Twinkle, still a current teacher as well. We're actually going to do algebra. Can't believe I'm saying it. Emma Louise, a very good afternoon to you.
Hiya. Yeah, hopefully, I think it's one of those things that fills people with dread. So well, hopefully if you are homeschooling and you see the word algebra, this might help you calm down a little bit.
Yeah, do you know, I mean, I didn't have a problem when I was doing it at school, but my kids' algebra now is so complicated that I haven't got a clue. And I pretty much gave up. My 16-year-old, by the time he was about 14, 15, it was already getting to the point where I couldn't really help him with it. So I hope you're not going to get too complicated.
No, we'll stay. I've got a few things prepared, so we'll do a little bit of sort of maybe year six, so yes. Upper end of primary.
Okay.
Pitched, and then that should
work all right. So tell us about the origins of algebra, because I think a lot of people comedians always used to say, what was the point of algebra? I never have to use it in real life. So what is the point of it?
I'm confident with this one. I'm confident that I can tell you that you use algebra probably more commonly than most of the other maths that you learn at school. And that's because although we might not be writing actual algebraic expressions, which are the ones that use, you know, the A plus 3C equals X type thing every day, that is what we are doing in our heads. So I've got some real life applications as well. So for example, this is one of our questions on one of our Twinkle resources actually, and it's there's a painter and decorator charging £16 for every hour that she works, and she offers a discount of £5 for each job. What she's literally doing in her head is 16h minus 5, and just because she's not writing that down doesn't mean that she's not using those skills to work out her end price.
Right, okay. So I mean, if you hadn't invented algebra, what would have happened though, for example?
We'd have probably just used something else. So the whole point of the letter is that the letter is used as a variable. So that painter and decorator could change what she charges per hour,
right,
and the formula would still be the same. We just change the 16 to whatever her hourly rate was.
Right.
But it means that we can keep the same formula and just change the bit that changes.
Right. So it's really about just almost standardizing something, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got an example for you. Do you want to have a, should we have a look?
Yes, go on.
I wonder if you think, I'm going to hold it up as well, so if anybody's watching, they'll be able to see it, but I'll read it out.
All right.
So I wonder if anybody thinks that in their day-to-day life, they might have used 5b plus 3a plus c equals p, and then we've got x equals n minus p.
Well, I know you're going to tell me I probably have without realising it, but that has completely thrown me, that.
See, it's made more complicated by the letters, but actually, what if I told you that I go to the supermarket,
right,
and I buy 5 bananas,
yeah,
and I buy 3 apples,
right,
and I buy a packet of crumpets,
yeah,
and that gives me the price of my total shop.
Okay.
And so, for example, if my bananas were 17p, my apples were 35, and a packet of crumpets was 95 pence, I'd do 5 times 17,
right,
and I'd do 3 times 35, and then I'd add my 95, which would give me a total price here.
Right. Okay.
If anybody wants to work that out, it's 285.
That's a lot of money for a very bizarre lunch, I have to say.
Well, there comes the next step. So it's 285 pence. Right. Of course, then you've got the extra step of changing that into pounds. And then X would be your change, which right, might be the note that you pay with minus the price that you've used. So although you haven't written this down when you've made your shopping list and you haven't been walking around the supermarket thinking 5B plus 3A equals, you haven't been doing that, but right, you have, you just don't think of it like
that. You
this.
Just don't think of it like that. And do people do that in their heads because they've been taught algebra then, do you think? Or is it just something that you would do anyway?
It's something that you do anyway, but algebra helps you helps you develop that skill. So we think of like the earliest algebra you do in school as possibly being something with a missing number. So right. 5 plus blank equals 7. And a very, you know, sort of a year one child might be working out what that blank space is. But actually, you do it a lot earlier than that. You see children when they're playing, they might have three toys in front of them and they misplace one. They know straight away that something is missing. They probably know that they've misplaced one toy just from the fact that they can see two.
Right. Okay. And at what sort of age would you say children should be taught algebra? Because I've always spoken to a lot of teachers who say that the younger the kids are when they learn stuff, the better, really.
Yeah, well, I think there's a big push at the minute on kind of getting that the depth of learning. So I know I teach year one at the minute, but I have taught year six. Now, year six do algebra. The unit is called algebra. Mm. They will be learning algebraic expressions with our numbers and our letters mix. But actually, for my small children in my class, they do sit and they do missing numbers, and they might do word problems. So if this person has three of these and this person have two of these, how many do they have altogether? And that's basic algebra.
Right.
So It does come in quite earlier than you think, I would imagine.
Okay, because I mean, some of the stuff that worries people, I would imagine, is when you start introducing sort of brackets and things. But brackets have a particular use in algebra, don't they?
Yeah, brackets make things easier. Brackets tell you, you know, sort that bit out first. You can work that bit out as a chunk.
Right, and you work out the bit inside the bracket, don't you?
Yeah, work out the bits inside the brackets, and then it's your multiplication and your division first always come before addition and subtraction as
right.
well.
And what about X and Y? Because they obviously appear more than most things in algebra. Is that just because of that's the way it is?
Yeah, they're just used as examples for variables. And if you find it tricky, if you read something that said, what is X? Put something in the way of X. So go, oh, well, instead of thinking I've got 5X, add however many X. Put something else in for X, so I've got 5 tennis balls.
Yeah.
And it suddenly becomes a bit more tangible.
Right, okay. And X is always the same if it's in one algebraic equation, presumably, is it?
Yes. If it's in one expression, X would always be the same. The same letter would always represent the same number.
Okay. And I mean, I think that was what threw me about your apples and crumpets, because I've never seen anything really other than X and Y, or much anyway. I mean, I don't do a lot of algebra now.
The classic is find X, isn't it? That's what they always say, find X.
Mm. Yes, and you don't normally see A or C or P, you know?
I think we come up against them quite a bit in some of our algebra work. But yeah, X and Y, definitely the ones you see the most.
Okay, so if you're a parent listening to this and you've got a kid who's a bit puzzled by the whole algebraic scenario, what's the best way of finding your way through it, if you like? You know, because, I mean, a lot of parents struggle with all sorts of questions they get asked by their children, like, why is the sky blue? You know, well, because it is. You know, what would you say to a parent who has to try and get a kid into it?
I would make sure that they knew that it does have a purpose. I've just shown you we are using it, even if we don't think we are. And some children learn differently, so some will really grasp that formula. So there's a set formula to it, and that's how you work it out. So, you know, if you're working on something a bit trickier, so I'll leave you with this. I won't make you do it now.
All right.
If anybody fancies finding X.
All right. I'll see if I write this one down.
Yeah, go on. I've got 5X minus 6 equals 3X minus 8. And at the end, I'll tell you now that X equals minus 1. But I wonder if anybody knows how I got that.
X equals minus 1.
Yeah. But if you have a child who's particularly good at knowing formulas...
Well, hang on a minute. What's 5 times minus 1 then?
5 times minus 1 is minus 5.
All right. So minus 5, minus 6. Blimey. See, that's already thrown me that. I'm already negative territory. No idea what I'm doing.
We'll have some children that are really good at remembering those kind of patterns of how to get things like that. But if this is something that absolutely would throw your child, this is obviously a little bit trickier. This is not primary level. But for primary school children, we can put real things in the place. Like I say, put the bananas and the apples in there if it helps them out. Make it into a word problem if it helps them out.
I mean, you could have given me one that wasn't minus something. I mean, you know, that was cruel. This is why people think algebra teachers are cruel.
Would you like me to talk you through it, or do you want me to leave
you
with it?
No, go on, tell me.
Okay, so we have I'm sorry, I'm having to read this backwards, so I want extra credit for this because I'm looking at the reverse on the screen. I've got 5x minus 6 is the same as 3x minus 8. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take away 3x from both sides because I'm going to try and get rid of as much as I can.
Okay.
So I'm going to chop the 3x off here and off here, which leaves me with 2x minus 6 on this side.
Yes.
And it just leaves me with minus 8 on this side.
So yes.
Tells me that 2x minus 6 is the same as minus 8. And then I'm going to add 6 to both sides to get rid of this minus 6, which gives me 2x equals minus 2.
Yeah.
And if I know that 2x is minus 2, then 1x.
Yeah. See, that makes sense. Now you're talking. So you can, the great thing about algebra then is you just take things out if you can't understand.
Yeah. Lots of them are really step by step. So if you have a child that's struggling with it, there is always a step by step guide to whatever you're doing.
Great. Well, that's good because now we've finished on a high because now I understand it. Thank you.
Had your brain worked out before lunch.
Yeah, I know. I must go and get something to eat. Emma Louise Rose, teacher, team leader at Twinkle Algebra for dummies like me. They've actually managed to make it sensible for me. That's good. I like all that. This is Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.